I wonder, have you ever made a promise to God? Has there ever been a time when you said you would be faithful to Him and Him alone? One of those times when you closed your eyes and thought, all I need is God. It's not like we don't mean such things when we say them. We do. But then we do what the people of Israel did. We hedge our bets.
That's the Reverend Dr. Jim Somerville. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is a new day of faith and hope. This is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thanks, Sherry. We're delighted to welcome back to Day One the Reverend Dr. Jim Somerville, who was with us 6 weeks ago. Jim is senior pastor of First Baptist Church of Richmond, Virginia. Before coming to Richmond in 2008, he served as pastor of the First Baptist Church of Washington, D.C. for 7 years. He's a graduate of Georgetown College in Kentucky and earned his Master of Divinity degree and his Ph.D. from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. Jim is also the co-founder of a unique new church resource, A Sermon for Every Sunday. Jim, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
6 weeks ago, you shared a bit with us about the church resource you've helped to develop, A Sermon for Every Sunday, but remind us what that is and how it can be used.
These are video sermons by America's best preachers for every Sunday of the liturgical year, based on the lectionary.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to the 23rd Sunday after Pentecost, you can find a great sermon by a great preacher available on video to project in worship or simply to use in small groups, house churches, or even for individual use.
And more information can be found on your website, asermonforeverysunday.com. Meanwhile, at the church you pastor, First Baptist Church of Richmond, Virginia, the kingdom of God is breaking out, I understand.
Everywhere.
Tell us about the initiative you've been leading there for several years now called KOH2RVA. Sounds like a license plate number.
It is a license plate. In fact, it's the license plate on my car.
Oh, wonderful.
Kingdom of Heaven to Richmond, Virginia.
Mm.
Shortly after I got to Richmond, we decided that this was our mission as a church. We wanted to see if we could help usher in God's kingdom. I know that's ambitious, but if you don't have big dreams, you'll never get off the pew.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 2012, we started a year-long every-member mission trip that we called KOH2RVA. And our hope was that during that year, we would begin to see the kingdom come.
Mm-hmm.
Every member of the church was supposed to be involved in some form of ministry or mission during the year, and a remarkable number of them actually were.
So what does seeking to build disciples, apprentices, as part of God's kingdom look like in Richmond?
We have started a leadership course called Legacy Leaders, and these hand-picked apprentices in our church are led through an 8-week leadership training course in which they are asked to produce a personal ministry plan. Mm. Each one of them comes out of that course doing something that will help bring the kingdom a little closer to Richmond. And over these last 3 years, we've graduated 60 people from that. It's changing the DNA of the church, Peter.
And your church has quite a history. Share a little bit of that with us.
This church goes back to 1780,
wow.
So we are 236 years old now. And there has been a real legacy of mission involvement through the years. In the past, that was mostly about raising support and sending missionaries to other countries overseas. I've been trying to help the church see that we have a mission field right here where we live, and to help each member think of himself or herself as a missionary to Richmond, Virginia. So what we're seeing is a lot of direct missions involvement that we haven't always had in the past, but we're building on that same legacy that began all those years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you've been known to often just wander around your city and strike up conversations.
Yes.
Still do that?
I started in Richmond by prayer walking the neighborhood and talking to people on their front porches when they were sitting out there, introducing myself, getting to know them. It's not so much about how many people can we get into our building mm-hmm. on Sunday morning. It's really about loving our neighbors. Mm-hmm. When I first came, the staff was asking me how we were going to reach the immediate neighborhood around the church. And I changed the question. I said, how are we going to love the immediate neighborhood around the church? Mm. Because until we love these neighbors, they're not going to trust us with anything we say. Mm-hmm. So that's been part of the agenda for these 8 years now, to reach out to our neighbors with love, to make this a vital center of ministry in the heart of that community.
Well, Jim, your sermon today is based on Hosea chapter 1, verses 2 through 10, another amazing Old Testament story. And once again, you're going to guide us through it. And we encourage folks to open their Bibles and read the passage after the program, perhaps, or later on today, Hosea chapter 1. The story seems like a bad soap opera with a lesson. And we look forward to learning more about it in your sermon today. It's entitled, God's Crazy Mixed Up Family. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. For several years, when I was a young pastor, I taught a fifth and sixth grade Sunday school class. And I would often ask my students if they knew what a covenant was. A covenant is a promise, they would answer, in unison. Those kids had been well taught. Just any kind of promise, I would ask? No, a special kind of promise, they would answer. Can you give me an example, I would ask? Like a wedding, they would answer. And they would be right. A covenant is like that very special promise made by two people when they get married. John, the minister asks, will you have Jane to be your wife? I will, John answers. Will you forsake all others and be faithful to her only as long as you both shall live? I will, he says. And Jane, the minister continues, will you have John to be your husband? I will, Jane answers. Will you forsake all others and be faithful to him only as long as you both shall live? I will, she says. And at the end of the ceremony, the minister pronounces them husband and wife. It is not unlike that covenant made between God and his people at Mount Sinai, that wedding in the wilderness, where God took Israel by the hand and said, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not bow down to idols or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Do you understand? And the people of Israel, like a bride blushing behind her veil, said, we do. They made a covenant. And the covenant between God and his people at its simplest was this. If you will be my people, I will be your God. But it was a conditional covenant. It began with the word if. Another way to say it then was, if you will not be my people, then I will not be your God. Understood? Understood, the people said. We will be your people, and you will be our God. And off they went, God and his people, toward their honeymoon in the promised land. But it didn't last long. Even before they got there, God figured out how things were going to be. In the 31st chapter of Deuteronomy, in one of those private moments with Moses, God said, soon you will lie down with your ancestors. Then this people will begin to prostitute themselves to the foreign gods in their midst, the gods of the land into which they are going. They will forsake me, breaking my covenant that I have made with them. And sure enough, that's just what happened. By the time we get to our text for today, some 500 years later, the people of Israel have worshipped every foreign god they can find, as if their lives depended on it. And it's probably because they thought their lives really did. if the rains didn't fall, if their crops didn't grow, they wouldn't have anything to eat. And if they didn't have anything to eat, they couldn't last long in the land that God had given them. When they entered the land of Canaan and learned that there was a local god, Baal, who was responsible for rainfall, they figured it couldn't hurt to toss a prayer in his direction, the way you might toss a coin into a wishing well. And when they learned that there was a fertility goddess named Anath, they figured it couldn't hurt to light a candle at her shrine either. Who knew? It might just help the crops grow. But don't miss the significance of what was happening. Although it might seem like a harmless flirtation with foreign gods, it was the beginning of the end of the marriage. Because when the people of God began to bend their knees to other gods, they were saying, in essence, "You, Yahweh, are not enough God for me. I can't count on you to provide for me, to fulfill my needs. So I'm going to worship these other gods as well, just to be on the safe side, just to make sure." But what may have begun with a casual prayer or the lighting of a candle soon became an orgy of idol worship. If one prayer was good, two prayers were better, right? And if one candle seemed to help, why not try a half dozen? And if the rains hadn't come or the crops were in danger, the people would head for the hills to worship. They would spread their blankets beneath the trees and engage in fertility rituals that went on for days, hoping to inspire the gods by their behavior. It broke God's heart. Not so much because of what they were doing, I think, as why they were doing it. Because they didn't trust him to provide for their needs. In the fourth chapter of Hosea, he says, "There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. My people consult a wooden idol and are answered by a stick of wood. A spirit of prostitution leads them astray. They are unfaithful to their God. They sacrifice on the mountaintops and burn offerings on the hills." What will God do with his adulterous bride? According to the terms of the covenant, he has every right to abandon her. He had said, "If you will be my people, I will be your God." But they had not been his people. They had behaved like prostitutes, as he says, chasing after every foreign god who walked down the street, batting their eyelashes at Baal, hanging on the arm of Anath, offering themselves to any god who would give them a taste of the good life. "If you will not be my people," God might have said, "then I will not be your God." He could have thrown them out of the promised land. He could have locked the doors and left them weeping on the threshold. He would have had every right. But that is not what he did. Instead, God went to Hosea and said, "I want you to do something for me. I want you to go and marry a prostitute. And I want you to have children of prostitution, because my people have prostituted themselves by worshiping other gods." It's not every day that you get such an assignment from the Lord, but unlike his fellow Israelites, Hosea was a faithful follower of Yahweh. What God said, Hosea did. And so he went down to the red light district of Samaria to look for a wife, and it was there that he found Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. Some people say Gomer, which is probably correct, but I say Gomer because I used to watch that television show. We can only hope that she was prettier than her name, which I found in a list of Hebrew baby names, followed by the warning, "You find it difficult to say no and mean it." So Gomer was just a girl who couldn't say no. Can you imagine how things went when Hosea proposed? "Will you marry me, Gomer?"
"Golly!
No, really. I want you to be my wife."
"Shazam!"
But in the end, she didn't say no. She said yes. It was a small but beautiful wedding with Diblaim weeping as he gave his daughter away, hoping that at last she would settle down. Hosea took her to the hill country of Judea for a brief honeymoon, and then they moved into a one-bedroom apartment overlooking the main street of Samaria. It was fun at first, freshening up the paint and adding some curtains, shopping for groceries together and eating off their wedding china. But eventually Gomer got bored, and one night Hosea came home to find her putting on her makeup. "Where are you going?" he asked. "Out," she said, and that's all she said. No matter how much Hosea pried, she wouldn't tell him more. He waited up for her as long as he could, pacing the floors and looking out the windows, but finally he went to bed exhausted. He woke up when he heard the click of the latch on the bedroom door sometime after 3. He didn't say anything, just lay there in the darkness as she undressed and got in bed beside him. But he could smell the cigarette smoke in her hair, the traces of someone else's cologne. It went on like that for weeks, for months. Gomer would sleep until the middle of the day and then, after supper, start putting on her makeup and getting dressed for work. She would stay out until the wee hours of the morning, sometimes coming home just before dawn to crawl in bed beside her husband. It was on one of those occasions that he finally confronted her. "Doesn't it mean anything to you?" "What?" she asked. "Our marriage," he said. "Doesn't it mean anything to you?" "Well, of course it does," she said, rolling toward him. "But Lord knows you're not going to get rich in the prophecy business. And somebody's got to make some money around here, especially since we've got a baby on the way."
"We do?"
"Mm-hmm. Hosea Jr. ought to be here in about 6 months." That was news to Hosea, and he wasn't sure it was good news. He lay there in the darkness doing the math, trying to figure out if there was any way the child could be his. He tossed and turned for a long time before deciding that even if it wasn't the child's fault. He would try to be the best daddy he could be. But then God told Hosea what to name the child. "Name him Jezreel, for in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." It's hard to love a child with a name like that. But Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a little girl. The Lord told Hosea, "Name her Lo-Ruhamah, not pitied, for I will no longer have pity on the house of Israel or forgive them. But I will have pity on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen." And when Gomer had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bore a son. Then the Lord said, "Name him Lo-Ami, not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God." And if Hosea hadn't gotten the message before, he got it now, that God has had just about all of Israel's unfaithfulness he can stand. Do you remember the covenant? "If you will be my people, I will be your God. But if you will not be my people..." I wonder, have you ever made a promise to God? Has there ever been a time when you said you would be faithful to Him and Him alone? At your baptism or your confirmation? At youth camp or during a prayer service or maybe on a mission trip? One of those times when you closed your eyes and thought, "All I need is God." It's not like we don't mean such things when we say them. We do. But then we do what the people of Israel did. We hedge our bets. They worshipped other gods because they believed those gods were responsible for things like rainfall and fertility, abundant crops and unprecedented prosperity. If taking an offering to the temple of Baal would make the rain fall, why not? What harm could it do? Well, every harm. It meant that God's people didn't trust God to provide for their needs. They bowed down before other gods just to be certain. And so do we.
Sure, it says on our money, "In God we trust." But we know that if we have enough money, we don't have to trust as much. And so, through the years, we have done what we could to make more. We have bowed down before the many small gods of the good life. We haven't done it because we didn't love God. We've done it because we wanted to be a little more secure, a little more comfortable. We've done it because we wanted to live in a nicer home or send our kids to better schools. We have found that the good life can be very good indeed. But along the way, our love for God has grown cold. Oh, we stay in the marriage. We maintain some show of faithfulness. But He is no longer the source of life and love for us. He is that old, tired husband we come home to when our eyes are still glittering from a night on the town. And today, through the prophet Hosea, he confronts us. He says, "You know, there was a time when you only had eyes for me, when you couldn't wait to be with me. But now you will climb into bed with any God who offers you a taste of the good life." He says it through tears, in a choked voice. He says it like someone who has finally decided that enough is enough. What will he do? I don't know. But I think Hosea knows. Hosea, whose life was lived as a metaphor of God's life, and whose own household provided a picture of God's crazy, mixed-up family. If I close my eyes, I can almost see him getting up in the night for a glass of water and stopping by the children's bedroom. He checks on Jezreel, his oldest, pulls the covers up under Lo Ruhamah's chin and kisses her cheek, strokes Lo Ami's head and sings him back to sleep. And then he pulls a chair up to the window to watch and wait. Maybe this will be the night she comes home early and tells him she's giving up her night job, that she has realized at last that he's everything she needs and all she ever wants. Maybe things will be different for them from now on. Maybe.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Dr. Jim Somerville, senior pastor of First Baptist Church in Richmond, Virginia. For a free printed transcript of his message, God's Crazy Mixed Up Family, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. That's 888-411-3291. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Day 1 depends on the financial contributions of our faithful listeners. If you appreciate our ministry, please consider sending a donation. We're grateful for your much-needed support. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week on Day 1, we're honored to welcome the very Reverend Sam Candler, Dean of the Episcopal Cathedral of St. Philip in Atlanta, Georgia. His sermon is entitled, "A Chasing After Wind." Be sure to tune in. Now, Jim Somerville offers some final reflections on today's message with our host, Peter Wallace.
Jim, you explained very well the covenant God made between the people of Israel. If you will be my people, I will be your God. They said yes, but it didn't last long before they started flirting with the gods surrounding them in the Promised Land. And by the time of our text for today from Hosea, some 500 years later, you said they have worshipped every foreign god they can find as if their lives depended on it. It seemed harmless at first, but they were in essence saying, "You, Yahweh, are not enough God for me." And whether we realize it or not, we fall into the same trap. How can we be more aware of the times that we flirt with things that take us away from God to avoid that slippery slope?
You know, years ago, I began to think of Baal, that Old Testament Canaanite fertility god, as the god of the good life. Because if the rain falls and the crops grow, life is good. But if the rain doesn't fall and the crops don't grow, life is not. So when I apply that to our modern American cultural context, it seems to fit. How often have we bowed down before the god of the good life, however we construe that particular god? What is it that makes life good for us, and how much time do we spend bowing down at those altars? So it helps to think about the difference between that God of the good life and the God who is actually good, the one who made us and loves us and wants us for his own, and who is able to supply our every need. I think sometimes our wants run away with us. But here is God giving us what we need and offering us the kind of life that is worth living, the kind Jesus said is abundant and overflowing and everlasting, and who could want more than that? And yet we do seem to sometimes look everywhere else but in God's direction to find what we want.
And instead of throwing them out of the promised land for breaking their covenant, God does something different. He has Hosea illustrate what's going on with Israel through his own marriage to a prostitute, Gomer. It must have been scandalous. She has three children that God names to make sure the message is clear to the people, but it doesn't really seem to work very well, though it might remind us of our own broken promises to God. What should we do if we realize now that we are in many ways as unfaithful to God as Israel was?
I think this picture that emerges from Hosea is so beautifully heartbreaking. I mean, to hear it, to read it, is to see ourselves in the mirror and to know that all our promises to God are promises that have been broken. I say in the sermon, maybe you can remember a time when you made your covenant with God, when it was going to be God and God alone from now on. But you can probably look back and see that that commitment hasn't held in the way you hoped it would. And so I think in asking Hosea to marry this woman, God is showing us what it feels like to be God. It's heartbreaking. And yet God doesn't rain down judgment on the people. He seems satisfied to show them what it's like. My hope is that in this sermon we'll get a glimpse of ourselves in the mirror and maybe renew some old commitments that we made, renew that covenant we made with God long ago.
Jim Somerville, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, Peter.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever.